Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, April 18th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Ryan Coogler's newest film, Sinners, and we'll present interviews with actors Delroy Lindo and Miles Caton. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
All right, folks, before we get into this, I just wanted to say that I saw this movie at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown Los Angeles, which was a pretty cool location. BJ, I assume you've been there before, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a great spot. I actually hosted a screening of Sleepaway Camp there.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. So shout out to Lynn, who works for the PR team over there. She hooked me up and it was just a really cool. They opened it like right before I moved. So I had never had a chance to go to that location before. I've been to like a couple Alamo Draft Houses around the country at various points. But big fan of that place. Really enjoy the whole vibe of it and the like the movie posters in the hallways, man. I know that's like a classic Alamo thing, but just really awesome environment to be in. Okay, so let's talk about this movie. I've been kind of scrambling around and moving locations from one Airbnb to another today, so I haven't really had a ton of time to wrap my mind around a bunch of coherent thoughts about Sinners, which I saw last night. But holy crap, what an incredible movie. And I think we're all on the same page about that. I guess I'll just open it up to general reactions before we get started. BJ, what did you think about this film?
Oh man, this is cinema, baby. This is cinema. I knew I was going to like this movie. I did not know that I was going to quickly become obsessed with this movie. It is, from just a technical standpoint, one of the like most well-crafted movies I've seen in probably 5 years. It is just firing on all cylinders in terms of its cinematography, its production design, the score. Like, it's just killer. But that screenplay and these performances are just the best of the best. Ryan Coogler has absolutely solidified his place more than he already has as one of the best directors we have working today. My God.
Yeah, absolutely. Brad, what'd you think about it?
Yeah, man, I dug the hell out of this movie. It's bold, it's thrilling, it's exciting. It has an incredible soundtrack. There are so many badass moments in it. It's bloody, it's action-packed. The performances are fantastic from everybody. It has an outstanding ensemble cast. I can't say enough good things about this movie. And like, I just hope everyone goes out of their way to see it, because this is the kind of movie people have been saying Hollywood doesn't make anymore. And like, nothing original or interesting is coming out. Like, you need to see this movie if you want those kinds of movies, because this has it all. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is the one that we wait for. You know, like, if we're lucky, we'll get a movie like this once a year, maybe twice a year, that just comes along and it hits all of our buttons, the things that we love in sort of like mainstream American blockbuster filmmaking, and it's just executed to the total highest level possible. And I'm kind of overwhelmed by the film because there are so many things to talk about. In some ways, it's kind of like my favorite type of movie, because on the surface level, you can just interact with it as just like a kick-ass story with, as you guys said, great performances that look great and all of that. But there's also like so much going on under the surface of this film and so many different reads on it, and like these things, these deeper ideas that Ryan Coogler is interested in interrogating and forming and kind of presenting to the audience and making us think about things. And God, there's just like so much thematic material to dig into here. So I guess I'll just ask you guys, well, let's just say spoilers for Sinners for the rest of this conversation, because this movie is like too good and there are too many details to censor ourselves in a conversation like this. And I hope, as Brad said, that all of our listeners who are checking this episode out have probably seen the movie by now or are planning to see it. So pause the episode and come back and listen to us after you have seen the film. But yeah, I wanted to ask if there was one particular theme or idea that this movie was kind of grappling with that stuck with you, because I know you guys saw the movie a little bit before I did. So, several days with the movie kind of under your belt and like percolating and thinking about it, is there one aspect of it that stands out to you? Brad, I'll start with you.
I think for me, like, one of the more bold things that Coogler does in this is how he uses music as both a plot device in this movie in kind of a like a mystical kind of fashion, and also in just this like incredibly striking oral and visual way in one particular sequence in this movie that just is packed with energy and transcends like time and like all sorts of musical stylings across various generations. And it's such a cool representation of like what music stands for, specifically music that has originated with Black people. And it's just such an uproarious, incredible sequence that is striking and stunning in so many ways. And I feel like it's just this really strong representation of, you know, the culture that is often underrepresented, and especially in movies like this. You know, we had a conversation in the Slash from Slack about like the last time there was like a Black vampire movie directed by a Black filmmaker. And like, it's been so long since that happened. And so seeing a movie like this come to life in such a vibrant way was something that was just really rewarding and fulfilling.
Yeah, that scene is incredible. I think we have to like pause and drill down on that because,
God, yeah.
Like, I was like levitating out of my chair when I saw that. I just could not believe what I was seeing, and I couldn't believe that Ryan Coogler was going there and kind of envisioned something that, yeah, just like bold, and like I'd literally never seen anything like that before. And the way that it ends, where the camera kind of goes up through the roof, where like the flames and it just opens on the or sort of a that long continuous shot like closes on the stars in the sky. It was just like, it's moving, but it's also this like it gave me goosebumps in some ways, you know, just like I couldn't believe the craft on display there and like this idea executed to this level. But BJ, what did you think about that when you saw that scene come together?
Oh, I had like a primal reaction to it. So I was fortunate enough to see Sinners back in like March at the IMAX headquarters out here in Los Angeles. And it was I don't know if it was the first like screening for people who didn't work on the film, but it was, you know, a very limited press screening. And that scene started happening, and I felt myself like looking around the theater to be like, are we all seeing this shit right now? Because like, this is, it's one of those movie moments where I was already in, I liked the movie. I was like, this is really good. And then the juke joint music scene hits, and I couldn't believe what I was watching. I was like, first off, like knowing what we know about this industry, I cannot believe that Ryan Coogler got away with making this movie exactly as he did. I know that both he and Bong Joon-ho were both given final cut for their movies. So like, shout out to Warner Brothers for like making those good decisions, because my God. But the scene hits and I was like, it's not often that you watch a movie and you're recognizing in real time, oh, I'm watching a masterpiece. Like, this is going to be a scene that we're going to be talking about for the rest of our lives. Like, this is what people must have felt like the first time they, like, watched Jaws or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, that's just so incredible. I'll mention the kind of like, I guess, deeper idea or theme that stood out to me, which was this idea that like these Irish vampires are coming in and want to kind of accumulate and like possess all of the blues and this Black culture, right? Like this, it kind of reminded me of like it was kind of like this film was in conversation with Jordan Peele's Get Out in a way. Like the kind of undergirding of that movie felt like there was some similarities in terms of some of the ideas that Ryan Coogler is working on here. So that stuck out to me. And I thought that was just like a really well executed idea, because I hadn't really seen it done like that before when Get Out came around. And I'm frankly surprised that we haven't seen it done more since, because that movie was so popular and so great. And that was a kind of movie that felt like it gave me a vocabulary to talk about an idea that no movie had ever given me before. And so, yeah, like I said, just kind of in conversation, it's interesting thinking about those two films on that same wavelength. But
oh, definitely. I feel like Sinners is taking the line in Get Out when Steven Root is saying, man, I want your eye. And like, that's what he's going after. He's like, I want your talent as a photographer. I want to steal the way that you see the world, because it's different than how I experience it. The same way that these vampires are very much like, we want to steal your musical power. And, you know, we had like a little bit of these conversations when like Baz Luhrmann's Elvis came out, and there's the like, oh, he's white conversation, which is played as kind of a joke, but like, that is real. And like, white people have been lusting after and coveting and stealing and co-opting Black artistry for as long as we've been documenting artistry. And so to see a movie treat that as like the foundational evil of these vampires and like the root of their evil, I think is just so brilliant.
Yeah. Was that the biggest idea that kind of stood out to you, BJ, or was there some other thread that really connected with you in some way?
The thing that I've been thinking about the most, and it is the subject of something that I wrote about for Slash Film, is the idea of actually treating vampires as evil and as villains, because vampires are one of the foundational monsters of the horror genre. They are a foundational monster to horror literature dating back to, you know, as early as the 17th century. But in recent years, vampires have sort of served as this allegory for like misunderstood outcasts or people unfairly pushed to the margins and made monstrous, to the point that there's been this reclamation of, you know, if they're going to treat us like monsters, we should embrace that. Let's be the monsters they claim that we are. There's something empowering about that. And I'm all for that. But at the same time, let's not forget that vampires are villains. Like, they're supposed to be evil. And to see a movie that is actually treating vampires not as something that is attractive or alluring or a type of way that we should aspire to be, but a genuine threat and an actual danger, I think is great. I love that we are returning to monsters being monsters because they are monsters and not because they've been made monstrous.
Mm-hmm. So the score of this movie is just unbelievable. And Ludwig Göransson, who has been working with Ryan Coogler for a long time, just really takes things to the next level here. We're just kind of talking about this in our Slack as well, but like the way the music shifts over the course of the movie and kind of gets into this electric zone when, I mean, there's a moment, I think it's really near the very end of the movie, where it is just Ludwig Göransson just absolutely shredding on electric guitar. It sounds incredible, but there are also these really quiet moments that reminded me of Michael Kamen's score for Lethal Weapon, where it's just this like really quiet, bluesy kind of ambiance setting tone that, man, it's just masterful. I cannot wait to just listen to this score and soundtrack on repeat. I think Chris Evangelista mentioned Oh Brother Where Art Thou when talking about this movie, when he mentioned it's on yesterday's episode, maybe Wednesday's episode. And I want to say he said it was like a cross between Oh Brother Where Art Thou, From Dusk Till Dawn, Assault on Precinct 13, and what is it? Demon, what's the movie, BJ?
Is it Demon Knight?
Yeah, Demon Knight, which I've never seen.
It's great.
I've seen all those other ones. So yeah, I love that. But Brad, what did you think about, like, I guess the musical component of this, like outside of that one scene that you talked about?
Yeah, no, I mean, the music itself is great. I mean, because you, first of all, you have the blues music that is played by Miles Catton and sung by various other characters, including, you know, you have Delroy Lindo's character who plays piano and the character played by Jamie, is it Lawson?
Lawson.
Yeah, Lawson. That's it.
Yeah.
Her character Perlene also sings. So that music, you know, has a certain energy and vibe to it. But yeah, like you said, the score itself also just rips, especially once it starts feeling a little more contemporary with the electric guitar creeping in there. And just like he just wails on it. And yeah, I loved everything about the music in this movie. This is one of those times when I was sitting in a movie theater and I'm like, as soon as I get in the car, I'm going to listen to this soundtrack.
Yeah. Another thing, kind of a very small aspect of this movie that still stood out to me and I really enjoyed was the idea of myth making and like these smokestack twins, these characters played by Michael B. Jordan. I love in movies where other characters are always talking up characters and like creating backstory for them. And I know there's like a show don't tell mantra in movie making, and we always kind of sometimes we'll ding filmmakers for basically talking too much and not showing us with action what's going on, right? And kind of painting the picture in a proper way. But there's something about when a really great filmmaker knows what they're doing and knows how to talk up their characters. And it just creates this incredible myth. Like these guys have come from Chicago. They have such a rich history. They were working with Al Capone, and there's like this gangster component to them, and they're coming back to their hometown. And even the idea of the guitar that they gave to their young cousin, Sammy, belonging to this like famous blues guitar player or something like that, right? Like, and that ends up being a lie at the end of the story, and it ends up that that guitar actually belonged to their dad. So like they are contributing to this myth around themselves, and like even, you know, it extends to like building reputation, and like the way that I forget whether it's Smoker Stack shoots that one guy in the ass and then shoots the other guy in the knee for trying to steal the car. Like, you just, it's about burnishing reputation and like creating myths on this kind of larger than life level. So that's just like a through line of the movie that is not really like focused on a lot, but I just love the way that that part of the story was executed. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts about that or Michael B. Jordan, his performances or anything along those lines.
Oh yeah. I mean, everything is wrestling and they're keeping kayfabe alive. Like that's what they're doing here. But I think that it is so smart the way that it's shown, because we learn so much about them based on what other people have to say about them. It's not like we're getting, you know, Smoke and Stack looking into the camera and being like, here's what we did when we were in Chicago. It's like, no, it's what they've other people have heard about them. And so then it also makes the moments where we really see them, especially like when we have, you know, Annie brought into it and she's talking about like the life that they had, and we're seeing who they really are as people versus, you know, when you have the option, yeah, print the legend sort of thing, I think is so, 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 so smart and so clever. Really loved the way that this world is shaped. I mean, I know everything that I need to know about them and how people treat them when they go to pick up Sammy, and you see the way that his father, the preacher, is like, these fucking guys again, like your cousins, but like, oh God, it's like, okay, I got it. These are the older cousins. These are the bad influences. You know, they're probably going to get up into some mischief, like, but everybody knows them. They're notorious. And I kind of love that. I think it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much joy in this movie too. I think about that moment where Stack is in the car with Sammy and like, he asks him to play the guitar for the first time, and Sammy just like goes off, and there's this just incredible blues performance. And Stack is just like exclaiming in the driver's seat. Like I think he knows that he can make money off of this, but there's also like, I can't believe I'm in the presence of this incredible thing that's happening too. And I just like that sensation is so infectious as a movie watcher. Like when characters act that way and kind of react that way to a certain situation, it's very easy for me to mimic that behavior, you know, and like feel that emotion coming off the screen and really like reflect it as a viewer. So I love that part of it, of the movie as well. And like all the dancing and stuff that happens in that juke joint, like there's just so much joy in this movie along with the viscera and kind of like crazy stuff that comes later.
Oh yeah. I'm right there with you. And so Miles Keaton, who is a relative unknown, I think, to general audiences, but he is sort of this like, he's a gospel prodigy, and also was touring with Her when he was only like 16, which is crazy. But if you watch videos of Miles Keaton when he's younger, because they're on YouTube of him like 12 years old and singing in these like giant like mega churches, you can just feel people reacting to his talent the way that we see it in this movie. And so that for me makes it that much stronger, because I don't just believe it because Michael B. Jordan's a great actor. I also believe it because he is that damn talented. Like, he affects people like that in real life.
Yeah, totally. So, Brad, what else about this movie did you want to talk about? I know I've been kind of like guiding the conversation here, but I just want to open it up to you if there was anything that jumped out at you that you wanted to mention here.
I wanted to point out just a little bit of a technical appreciation, because I think it's something that we kind of take for granted nowadays, because it's conceivably and perceivably something that's easy to do nowadays with visual effects and the kind of technology we have. But it's how convincing it was to have Michael B. Jordan playing twins in this movie without ever feeling like you knew, you know, like which you know, where the double was or anything like that. And there's one particularly super tiny moment that unless you're actually looking and paying attention for it, like you won't even see or probably would never even acknowledge. And it's something that I just happened to catch because I was looking at the screen at the right time. And it's when we first meet them and they're standing by the car, and I forget whether it's Smoke or Stack, but he lights a cigarette and he hands it to his brother. And the change off of the cigarette is so seamless and smooth to the point where the hand movement of one of the twins accidentally like hits the cigarette before he gets his fingers around it. And like you see the cigarette get nudged slightly as he grabs it. So like there's just it's absolutely seamless and it's incredibly well done. And I think it's something that often we just don't ever think, oh yeah, well, that's, you know, super, super hard to do. But like, it's incredible. They can do it in such a way where you don't even see the strings.
Yeah. Such a ballsy shot too, right? Like just a statement of purpose and like holding on the frame for that long and just being like, yep, we're doing this. I'm bringing you into this world. We're going to sit on this shot for so long that hopefully you maybe think about it for a second, but eventually just buy the fact that these are two different characters, you know?
Oh, definitely. I talked with in my interview with Delroy Lindo, and he shouted out Percy Bell, who is an actor in his own right, but he served as the double for Michael B. Jordan. So he also had to learn both Smoke and Stack, because sometimes he's playing Smoke for Michael B. Jordan as Stack and vice versa. And so I guess that was really helpful for all the actors so that they would always know, you know, who Michael B. Jordan is playing at any given moment. But like, mm-hmm. that's incredible. You're essentially training two actors to play your lead. Like, that's nuts.
Yeah. God, I feel like we're 20 something minutes into this conversation. I feel like we could probably go for like another half an hour talking about all the moments and incredible stuff in this film.
Right.
Especially like the catharsis that I felt at the end when he just like grabs that Tommy gun, is just blowing away the KKK members. I was like pumping my fist in the theater. I guess we do need to transition into your interviews, BJ, because you spoke with Miles Caton and Delroy Lindo, which is awesome.
I want to mention one other cool thing real quick, because I wrote an article about this, and it's just a good thing to talk about too. But so if you can, you should see this movie in IMAX, because it's one of those movies where part of it was actually shot in IMAX for the large format. And so the my screening that I saw for my press screening was an IMAX theater. It wasn't like what you would call a legit IMAX, but it also wasn't like one of the smaller end crappy LIMAX theaters either. It was somewhere in the middle where you still get the scope and size of like a typically bigger screen and a good sound system, but it's not quite the full IMAX experience, but it was still very cool, especially in this one shot in the climax of the movie, because I'm allowed to talk about that, right?
Yes, yeah.
So it's when everyone is kind of upset, especially this character Grace, played by Lee Joon Lee, because her husband has been turned into a vampire, and she's just in a rage, and she lights a Molotov cocktail, and she makes the angry mistake of saying, "Come on in, motherfuckers," so that the vampires are invited in. It's such a cool moment, and it's made even better because it expands from the widescreen format into the IMAX, where you see the bars disappear and you see everyone lined up ready to fight the vampires coming in. And it reminded me of that sequence in Hunger Games: Catching Fire, where the ratio expands as Katniss is being taken into the arena after Cinna is killed in front of her. And it just creates this incredibly badass vibe where you're like, oh shit, let's get into it.
Man, oh yeah. Our theater rules. The second that happened, because we were at like IMAX headquarters, so like it was the best possible IMAX experience. And the second that happened, the whole room was like, oh yeah.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. I did not see this movie in IMAX, and now I really wish I had, because that sounds like an incredible moment. Okay, so yeah, BJ, any closing thoughts, I guess, before, like, just in talking about this movie in general before we dive into your interviews?
The only thing that I want to say is, one, I cannot believe I got 20 minutes with a living legend like Delroy Lindo. It is a high point of my life. I don't have the words to properly express how just unbelievable it was to just get to talk to him, especially because he fought for me to have my full time. These junkets are very difficult and they're trying to get people in and out. It was towards the end of the day and he fought for me to have my full time. So not only is he just like one of the greatest living actors that we have, but also just a real stand-up guy. And then, yeah, y'all hear it. And also there are aspects of this interview that did not make it into the final print. He tells a really great story about Blackula that is exclusive to this podcast that y'all are going to love.
Okay, well, let's transition. Actually, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and get right into your interview with Delroy Lindo.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.
As of yesterday, it was exactly 1 year ago that your casting in, at the time, was being called Ryan Coogler's Mysterious Vampire film was made. So I would love for you to take me back to that. How were you approached about joining this project?
Sure. I received a text from Ryan that said, "Do you play piano?" And I texted back and I said, "I don't play keyboard, but you know, I did a lot of, I took a lot of lessons when I did Crooklyn back in 1993, whatever year that was, in 94. And I think I said, "Why do you ask?" I didn't hear anything. He sent me a couple of additional texts over the next 2.5-3 weeks. And then finally, the last text he sent me, I said, "What's this about, man?" And he said, "I have a project I want to talk to you about." We set up a Zoom, and it developed from there.
Ugh, I love that. I love that he's kind of breadcrumbing you a little bit of like, what can you do? What can you do to get you in here? I think that's very fun.
What's interesting, though, when I said I didn't play piano, I thought, well, maybe he went and found somebody who could play piano. I didn't know.
Oh, fascinating. So a lot of actors are apprehensive, I will say, about dabbling in a genre like horror, because there's this misconception that horror movies are inherently like lesser than. So was there any hesitancy about that with you once you found out what the movie's really about?
But I have to tell you, I never saw the film as horror. I didn't see it as a horror film. When I read the script, I interpreted the story to be about what happens when a community is infiltrated and turns on itself. That's how I responded to the script. And I told Ryan that's what I felt. I gave him my impressions after having read it once, and he affirmed my impressions. And not only did he affirm my impressions, I also told him where I thought the script needed work, and he agreed with me. So from day one, we were on the same page in terms of the direction that we wanted to take the work.
I love hearing that. I mean, I think people forget often that we use horror terms like vampire to describe real people. We don't actually mean, you know, that they're blood-sucking vampires, but we mean the people that take things from you, the people that attack you. So I love hearing...
Amen.
I love Amen. Hearing that you approach this not as, you know, a horror film, but as this is a very real story.
Can I say something really quickly?
Of course, quickly?
As I've been talking to your colleagues, I've come to the conclusion that the horror that's associated with this narrative is what happens indeed when a community turns on itself. What happens when that community starts to exert violence on itself, within itself, which is intra-violence. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's a very contemporary story. And it's a story that we, as Black people, we struggle with that, because quite a bit of the violence that takes place in our communities is we inflict it on ourselves. So it's very contemporary in that sense, from that standpoint.
Absolutely. I think there's also this layer of how assimilation won't save you. Assimilating into what these vampires are bringing.
Beautiful.
Like, that doesn't help anybody, even when they're taunting and they're like, join us, it's better this way, is it? Because you're vampires now.
You know what? That's brilliant. Assimilation won't change you. What I've loved about talking to yourself and various of your colleagues, the takeaways that people have. One lady came in here and she said it made her think about freedom. What is freedom? And is freedom even a real concept? I love that, because what it confirms or affirms and confirms for me is indeed this film, this story is about more than the genre that it's set in. It's much bigger than that. And it's grappling with bigger issues.
Absolutely. And I think the scene in the juke joint where everybody's dancing and the music is playing is one of the, like, those magical moments where, as a viewer, you sit there and you have the realization, I'm watching brilliance in action. Like, I'm watching something that is so much bigger than what you thought this movie was going to be. So I'd love if you could talk about, like, what the energy was like on that day when you have all of these, you know, just generational representations of Black music and Black artistry all sort of, like, converging into one scene.
I did not know that the scene would work as well as it does when we were actually filming it. I was not aware of that, but I was aware of the narrative reach. I was acutely aware of what Ryan as a storyteller was reaching for, and I was all in, because I knew what he was doing. I knew what he was going for, and I was more than happy to be part of. I didn't know how I would fit into that journey, but I was more than happy to be in the scene, part of that journey, telling that aspect of the story, because what he's saying very, very clearly is the musical tradition that comes from this community, that comes from our community, that comes from African people, that comes from African descended people, I'm presenting you the continuum in all of its manifestations, from the drum, the African drum, through to hip hop, through to scratching on a turntable, through to classical European ballet, through to the Chinese monkey. If Lili were here, she would articulate it much more eloquently than I am. But the two representations of Chinese history and culture, he had all of it. So what he's doing is presenting the continuum and the strength and the brilliance and the genius of that continuum.
Yeah, it was like a breathtaking scene. I was already all in on the movie, absolutely loved it, but that scene hits, and that's when you're like, there it is. Like, this is, it's
there it is. There it is. And how does that scene, quote unquote, end? The pin that's put in that scene is those three people watching, and you see it in Remick's eyes, in his whole being, the lusting, that's what I want. It's brilliant storytelling as far as I'm concerned.
It is. It's absolutely breathtaking to watch. And that is the moment where you just, everything in your body just drops, because we know how this is going to end. We know what happens when white people are coveting, you know. It's a lot. It's a lot to process.
And lusting after. Coveting and lusting after. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So there are going to be a lot of folks rightfully praising Michael B. Jordan and his dual role, but something that I think also deserves to be paid attention to is how effortlessly the cast was able to make it clear which twin they were talking to based on their shifts in chemistry. So what was it like for you as an actor having to play opposite of someone else in a dual role and having to, like, adjust between whoever you're talking to, but it's still Michael B. Jordan?
Well, we were helped immeasurably in those sections of the work, because Michael had a young actor by the name of Percy Bell, who, when Michael was playing Stack, Percy was performing Smoke. When Michael was playing Smoke, Percy was playing Stack. And Percy was always there, and Percy had a very challenging job, because Percy's the space that Percy had to fill was creative in terms of going full bore in the scene and giving us actors what we needed, but it was also very technical because there were very specific movements, very specific physical positions that he had to adopt that Smoke or Stack would be creating on the other side of the scene. And so he had to be very precise about what he was doing. But he helped us immeasurably in terms of manifesting acting in those scenes.
Oh, that's amazing. I love hearing
that. It is amazing. And Percy, Percy Bell, who I completely forgot about mentioning yesterday, we've been going out of our way today to mention him, to give him his flowers, and to acknowledge the huge contribution that he made to the making of this film.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, kudos to Percy. That's great stuff.
Kudos to Percy.
So I was doing a little bit of digging through my horror history encyclopedia, that is my brain, and William Crane and William Marshall broke new ground with Blackula, the first vampire film to have Black lead actors and a Black director. And then I went through and I was trying to figure out how often this happens in the vampire genre. And obviously we have Ganja and Hess. And then we have Spike Lee's To Sweet Blood of Jesus, which is his interpretation of Ganja and Hess. And that's kind of it. There are a lot of incredible Black vampire films, but it's very rare that a Black vampire film also has a Black director. So what is it like for you to be a part of a project that is contributing to this upsettingly low number?
I'm thankful. I'm grateful. I don't think of the, I don't think of my trajectory as an actor. I don't quite think in those terms until somebody such as yourself brings it to my attention, right? So I'm saying, you know what? I'm thrilled to be part of that trajectory. I'm thrilled to be part of that continuum. And I hope, I kind of sort of know better, but I hope it starts a trend of work that continues to push the medium forward in terms of supernatural storytelling that we are protagonists in. And one other just side note to the Blackula, we were friends with Vanetta McGee is also in that film, in Blackula. And we were, Vanetta has since passed. Rest in peace, Vanetta. We were friends and neighbors in Oakland, California. And tight friends with Carl Lumley, who was her husband at the time, and her son, Brandon. We still are in contact with them. So kudos to Vanetta, yeah, who was in that film, Blackula.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a beautiful kismet small world we live in sometimes. I think that's really beautiful. So when people see Sinners and they go off into the night, what sort of conversations are you hoping they have on that drive home about the movie?
It's very broad, my answer. I hope the conversations involve, when you think about your response to the film and the thoughts that you've had, the kinds of thoughts that have been engendered, I hope that they are the kinds of conversations about what happens when certain people show up and lust after lust after the gifts that we have. I want that to be part of the conversation. I want it to be, I want a discussion about freedom. One of your colleagues came in here and said, she said it messed me up because it got me thinking about freedom and what does freedom mean? And is freedom even a real practical reality? I want people to talk about that. I want people to talk about, as you said, whoa, why is it that this genre of films that have Black protagonists, why is it so tiny? What do we do about that? I want that to be part of the conversation. I want people to talk about Ryan Coogler, man, a supreme filmmaker, and look what he has done, and he's just added yet another supreme achievement to his very young resume. This is a cat, how old is Ryan? And he's got Fruitvale Station, Creed, Black Panther, we're still taping, Black Panthers 1 and 2, and they, he has this. And every single film that he has shared with audiences, and this is unique, every single film that he has shared with audiences have been both critical and commercial successes. How many filmmakers, I don't care how old you are, how many filmmakers can say that? And how many filmmakers can say that? Mm-hmm. That kind of success in a relatively young filmmaker, and it's unique, and it feels very particular as a creative worker to be part of that, I want to say community. And I say community in hopes that Ryan and I can work together again in the future. Who knows what will happen? But that's why and how I'm saying that.
Yeah, I push back against it when people like to pit directors, especially if they, you know, come from a similar like marginalized community where it's like Ryan Coogler's the next Spike Lee, Ryan Coogler's the next whoever.
Amen.
But it's like Ryan Coogler is Ryan Coogler, and
all
he's making incredible work. But I guess on that note though, like when you work with him, you know, what is the magic spark that he has where you just, because I feel like everyone who's worked with him is like, there's just something about him. He just gets it. I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
Okay, but before I answer that, I will say that the work is made also for people like yourself who get it. The work is made for people like yourself who say, no, Ryan Coogler is not the next anything. Ryan Coogler is Ryan Coogler. And I believe the reason that you can discern that is because you're plugged into the humanity that we bring, your own humanity. And you know, in terms of your own humanity, that you are an individual. Your ethnicity aside, whatever your ethnicity is, it doesn't matter. It does matter in as much as you claim that and that's part of who you are. But in terms of what you do in the world, don't compare you or any of us to anybody else. We are all individuals forging our own path. But to your question, this is such a difficult industry. Look, life is difficult, right? But to be engaged in this creative arena and the kinds of challenges that and obstacles that get placed in front of us because of who we are, not because of what we do, because of who we are and who people perceive us to be. The kinds of challenges that are placed in front of us that we have to navigate every single day. I'm hopeful. I kind of sort of know better, but I'm hopeful that it's a paradigm shift. And I am thrilled to be part of that paradigm shifting work, both for myself as a creative worker and to be connected to this kind of work. Because I've said it a bunch of times over these last few days, this is why I became an actor. I didn't become an actor because I wanted to say to audiences, ooh, 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 look at me, look at me, look at me. That's not why I became an actor. I became an actor because I wanted to be involved with work that spoke to and changed in some way the human condition. And I know that sounds really lofty, and I understand. It sounds kind of highfalutin, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be involved with work that made people think, and maybe in some instances changed the way people think. So, a long-winded answer, and I'm not even sure what your question was, but it's really it's really gratifying and rewarding to be involved with this director at this point in his career, making this kind of work and sharing this kind of work with audiences. I know I didn't answer your question, but...
No, that was beautiful, though. Like, and I think you did answer that question, because Ryan Coogler is making that work. Like everything that he touches, I think, because he's now established himself as this name that, four quadrant mainstream, like everybody knows, they're gonna dial in, they're gonna lock in and pay attention to his work. So, yeah, I think you totally nailed it.
I pray so. I pray so. And while on some level, yes, there's a connection between Spike Lee and Ryan Coogler, for instance. And of course, there are many other directors out there working. I'm talking about those two because they are part of my direct experience. Because indeed, they are. There's a connection between Spike Lee and Ryan Coogler. That doesn't mean that they're each not their own persons, their own human beings, telling their own stories, stories that are important to them. So it's a double it not double-edged. It's a dichotomy, and it's a really interesting dichotomy. And I think you asked a question about what I want sinners to do. I hope that's part of the conversation. And how do we, I was going to say, how do we make space for filmmakers coming up? But maybe that's not the question. I just hope the space, that filmmakers coming up make their own space. So in 2, 3, 4 years, we're talking about another young filmmaker, male or female, who has done something, who has engaged work that shifts the paradigm. And that causes us to say, oh, dang, we have Spike Lee, we have Ryan Coogler, and now this person, and the person coming behind them. I pray to God that's what happens. I don't know if it will happen. I'm not naive about the world that we live in, but in a perfect world, I would love for that to be one of the results of a film like Sinners and the career of somebody like Ryan Coogler and
Agree
Spike Lee.
completely. Well, that's my time with you today. Thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful, and
Thank you.
congratulations on yet another incredible movie.
God bless you. Thank you very much. God
Have a
bless.
great rest of your night.
Tell your friends, tell your colleagues, and if they can see it in IMAX, please do so.
Oh,
God bless.
absolutely.
God bless you. Take care. Bye now.
All right, so that was awesome, BJ. And now you had a chance to speak with Miles Keaton. I think this one was on the phone, so the audio quality might be slightly different, but I think it's still good enough for this podcast for sure. Anything you want to say in terms of setup for this one?
Oh yeah, all I'm gonna say is like he this th this dude's got it. Like he's s like such a talent. I cannot believe that this is his first like true feature film acting. I cannot wait to see what he does next. But if you're unfamiliar with him musically, check him out, because he has so much more to offer, even just beyond this movie.
Cool. All right, here is BJ's interview with Miles Keaton.
So Sammy spends a lot of the first half of this movie listening to and absorbing the teachings of his cousins, Delta Slim, and just about everyone else he comes in contact with. As a newcomer to the world of feature film acting, did you find yourself having that in common with Sammy when working with your castmates and Ryan Coogler?
Absolutely. I felt like we were definitely experiencing that at the same time. You know, the same way he was learning from Delta Slim and learning, I was learning from those people in real life, you know, every day, just seeing their process and, you know, kind of just walking into it with an open mindset, you know, and really getting to just submerge myself in the different things that were going on set and, you know, learning about, you know, the different cameras and IMAX and just so much to learn every day. It was a dope experience.
I love that. I mean, what a project to have your feature debut in, right?
It's crazy.
And I mean, as for a feature debut, there's also so much being asked of you beyond acting. There's physicality of fight sequences, an intimacy scene, holding your own against living legends like Delroy Lindo, and of course, needing to do this musical performance that is so powerful that it transcends time and reality. I'd love to know which aspects of playing Sammy excited you the most, and which ones did you find most intimidating?
Most intimidating for me was, I probably have to say, like, definitely some of the more serious scenes, like some of the more emotional scenes. You know, those were kind of difficult for me to tackle coming into this as a new actor, but I had the help of Beth McGuire. She's an incredible acting and dialect coach, and she helped me to really break down the script in those like difficult times and kind of helped me figure out what the, you know, how to navigate through those emotional parts and really, you know, try to play those well through the screen. So those were some of the more challenging roles. And then for me, the fun stuff was definitely like the action and, you know, just getting to really like dive into that. I'm a big movie watcher. So to get behind the scenes and see how all of that stuff works in person, it was dope.
And especially because this is, you know, this is very much a horror movie. And so you're also dealing with a lot of fake blood, a lot of prosthetics. What was it like for you being on set and sort of seeing how the sausage is made when it comes to genre films?
Yeah, that was crazy for me. Like, I remember, like, probably before, a little before we started filming, they had me drive out to Jersey to like, an FX shop. And I got to do, like, get, like, prosthetic molds, like, made of my face. And, you know, they showed me how they were planning to do, like, this different scarring and different stuff like that. So just to see that process was really, really cool for me. And then getting the set, you know, you see everybody else's stuff and you see the teeth and everything. It's just like, wow, like, you know, everybody plays such an intricate part in making it, you know, making the screen like feel important, making it, you know, just play well. So that was fire.
Love that. Do you think you've gained a stronger appreciation for the movies that you do watch and enjoy now that you see just what goes into it?
Absolutely. I mean, when you see the end credits and you see every single person that played a part, you see that on set. It's like, you know, a lot of people working every day, working really hard to make sure that everything comes together. And it was a dope community that was built on set. You know, it felt like a family. Everybody was working together for a common goal, and that's what I'm about too. So, yeah.
Amazing. And so critics, myself included, are already calling Sinners one of the best movies of the year. Was there a moment during production where you had that thought yourself and realized, oh, we're really making something special here?
Yeah, for sure. It was actually on the day of Wrap. They had put together like a 10-minute, you know, just clip of everything we had shot, you know, and we all sat there and watched it. And I think we all had a realization like, wow, this is something really special. Like you felt it throughout the whole process, just everything that was going on. But in that moment specifically, after we had done all the work, just to see how that came together and see Ryan's vision come to life, I think we knew that we had something special.
I love that. I love when people know in the moment that they've made something that's going to really resonate with a lot of people. And I mean, watching the big scene at the Juke Joint, it really does feel like your performance is going beyond the world of film and just bringing the audience into the movie directly. So I'd love to know, have you ever witnessed a musical performance that sort of made you feel that same way?
Ooh. That's a good one. You know what? I gotta say Coldplay. Coldplay.
Nice.
When I was 16, I got an opportunity to go on tour and sing background for her. And I think it was around like 2022 or 2023, we opened up for Coldplay. We went on a European tour. And I remember the first time we saw their show, Coldplay show, and it was just crazy. Like, we performed at Wembley Stadium, and it was like 50, 60,000 people, and everybody in the room was just like in awe of like the whole production and just the sound. So that was one for sure.
Oh, that's great. Because I wrote this question down, and then I, of course, had to think about it for myself. And I was like, mine was the first time I saw Elton John and just watched him play piano. And I was like, how are you a human being? Like, just one of those things that, you know, it transcends. It's like Sammy's performance, it transcends. But I'm glad that you brought up, you know, touring with her, because you have such an extensive background in gospel and R&B, and you've been in the public eye for your entire life, and people have been appreciating those talents your entire life. Like, I cannot begin to tell you how many YouTube videos exist of you as a kid with, like, headlines like, Miles Caton can sing, or you gotta hear this kid. So I'm very, very curious that in the short amount of time that critical reception of this film has been out, how has it been starring in a feature film that is, as a publication, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, universally loved by everyone that's seen it, and knowing that you're a major part of that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel extremely blessed and grateful. Like, this is, you know, as shocked as I am and as, you know, lost for words I am at how, you know, the response has been and, you know, just doing the film, I'm extremely grateful to God for the opportunities that he presents in my life. I feel like, you know, from the time I was a kid till now, everything has kind of just been like a stepping stone. I've been, you know, working pretty hard, you know, for these type of opportunities. So to be in this moment now is, it feels great.
That's wonderful to hear. And, you know, speaking of performing in this movie, I've interviewed a lot of people who are both actors and singers, and something that a lot of people say is they have an easier time performing in these big venues like a Wembley Stadium than they do the intimacy in front of a camera. I'm curious, is that similar for you?
Absolutely, for sure, 100%. It's definitely the intimate rooms that you know, it's kind of, it's a little shaky, but I felt like I definitely was able to translate, you know, having that experience on stage to being on the camera. I just kind of had to figure out, you know, kind of like the specifics, like how to get that same emotional quality, but just bring it to the camera. But it's definitely two different things for sure.
Well, that is all the time that I have with you today. Thank you so much for chatting with me, and congratulations on a phenomenal debut.
So much. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
All right, guys. Again, I feel like we just kind of barely scratched the surface with this movie. There's so much to talk about, like the ending with Buddy Guy and like the bar where it's set in the 90s where they come in later, and the costuming, and especially on Michael B. Jordan in that scene, is just incredible. I just feel like we haven't even talked about half the movie, but
sorry BJ,
go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, yeah, we don't need a franchise, but if Ryan Coogler was like, here's the 90s vampires, here's what they've been up to, and it's like all about them trying to track down like old Sammy, here's my routing number, like, how do I make this happen?
Yeah, and actually, like, that's one of the things I think is so cool, because like at a time we're at where like people are kind of exhausted by credit scenes now, some of it because we're a little bit tired of Marvel, and like it always seems just like this shoehorn setup for like, oh, here's what's coming next. This was a movie where you're not necessarily expecting it to be a franchise, thinking that there's going to be a sequel or anything obvious at the end of the actual movie that leaves it open for like, oh, something else is going to happen. They're going to come back. And so this credit scene is such a nice surprise because it will continue the original story. It feels like it'll do it in a way that's exciting and different, because it would be so cool to see like a 90s set vampire movie with Michael B. Jordan, Haley Steinfeld, you know, as this, you know, just sexy team. And then it kind of opened up the possibility for like, oh, okay, so we jump forward this far for a second movie. If there's a third movie, you could easily see it being set like in the future or something like that. And that would just be fucking awesome.
Yeah, and I love that Ryan Coogler was fighting for control of this movie. I think the idea is that he gets the rights back after like 25 years or something like that. So just a really cool move on his part. And I love that, as BJ said, like, shout out to Warner Brothers for actually like coming to terms with him on this and letting him make the movie that he wanted to make, because it's incredible. It's definitely my favorite movie of the year so far. Brad, I'll give you the final word, because I know that like we didn't really have a ton of time to talk about stuff, but anything else about this movie that you wanted to shout out before we wrap it up here?
No, man, just see this movie. Like, if you're on the fence, you know, if you're not sure, if it feels like horror movies sometimes aren't your thing, like, just give this one a chance. It's done so well. It has so much like bold energy in it. It's infectious. The action's incredible. There's a good story, and like, it's more than just your typical vampire movie. Like, it's, I can't say it enough. This is what we want out of studios, what we want original movies, If you're tired of the same old shit, like, you got to see this movie.
Absolutely. All right. I'm going to link to our review of Sinners, which was written by Jeremy Mathai. I'm going to put that in the show notes. So I encourage people to check that out to get his perspective on the movie. And that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Sinners at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.